Thanksgiving seminar. He's here for a week. I missed 3 days of him, to my regret. But it's really good to have Jamie back. Jamie was a former postdoc at Perimeter. He does all things kind of the nation, quantum information. And
not all things.
Well,
too much.
Good.
Pretty sorry. Thanks everyone for coming today. It's great to see you all again. It's great to be back at Perimeter. It's full glory. Last time I was here, the tape on the floor. Sir.
Is it good now?
That's
fantastic. All right, so I'm going to be talking about this very nice task in quantum called anti-distinguishability. Okay, and I'll introduce the co-authors as the story progresses. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about two things. So I'm going to motivate the task in familiar territory. Or it might be familiar, talking about quantum state distinguishability. Okay, so I'll go through that and get everyone up to speed. And then I'm going to put a slight twist on the problem and talk about anti-distinguishability. Okay, it's going to be a very related task. If you have any questions, just shout out. I don't think the talk is probably going to last a whole hour, so feel free to talk as much as you want. Or I may ramble on, we'll see. So state discrimination. So here's the setting. Alice is going to prepare one of two states. Okay, so in this case, it's just 0 or 1, very simple states. And what she's going to do, create the state, send it over to Bob like that. And the question is, can Bob distinguish what those two states are? Okay, so let's just do a quick sanity check. What Alice is doing is she's going to create this as a physical thing, okay? She's gonna encode the state in either 0 or 1, send that to Bob, okay? What she's not going to do is take a piece of paper and write ket0 on it, okay? Or write down a vector, you know, and email it. She's going to have a state prepared in one of those two things. And Bob knows what these two things are, 0 and 1, okay? So all the information is pretty much public. The only thing Bob doesn't know is which one of these two Alice actually did. She went behind a curtain, prepared the state, and is sending it to Bob. Is that somewhat clear so far? All right. So the question is, can Bob distinguish? And in this case, it's very easy. You can just measure it, and 0 and 1, it's 0 and 1, okay? So if he gets a 0, he knows it was ket0. If he gets a 1, it's ket1. So this is kind of the game as you would play it. Okay, so there's one of two states. Let's call this state Psi1 and Psi2. Psi1 is sent over to Bob. And if Bob measures it, and from his measurement he infers that, he makes a guess that it's Psi1, then in this case he would win the game. Okay, and if he guessed Psi2, he would lose the game. All right, so you could just think of this as some kind of operational task or some kind of game if you want. So now we're going to change the states. Okay, now we have 0 and the plus state. Okay, and exact same thing, but now Alice is going to prepare one of those two, send it over to Bob like that. Question is, does Bob have any hope now? Okay, and now, I mean, the answer is it depends on how you define hope. Okay, so you can have some partial probability of being correct, but he can't perfectly distinguish these two states. Okay, and in general, two states are perfectly distinguishable if and only if they are orthogonal to each other. Okay, so I think a lot of people have probably seen this before, but any questions about this? With the setting or anything? Okay, so this is the setting that we're going to be looking at. We're talking about state discrimination, Shrutita. I taught you this before, so I know you know this. So now this is the general thing. We have a bunch of mixed states. Okay, in the general setting, row 1 up to row n. Alice has row I, and she's going to send this over to Bob like that. Okay, it doesn't have to be pure state, although we'll concentrate on pure states for this talk. And then the idea is, can Bob guess what I is, the index? Okay, so this one subtle point I wanted to point out is that you're not guessing what the state is necessarily. You're guessing which one was prepared. You're guessing the index, okay? So to help, you know, kind of sort that out, imagine they were all in the zero state. Bob just can't say, oh, you sent me the zero state, okay? He actually has to say which index it is, which means if they're all the zero state, it's actually a very hard problem, as opposed to just guessing zero state, which would be a trivial problem, okay? So it really is, he has to guess the index. And under what conditions can Bob perfectly guess what I is? And let me set this up as, you know, what Bob would actually do. And the idea is that he's given a quantum state that's encoding an index, and he wants to guess an index. So the only, pretty much the only thing he can do is just measure it, okay? So there's going to be some POVM M1 up to MN, and on output J, that's going to correspond to his guess J, okay? So there's no I don't know measurements here. It's just he has to guess one of them. And Bob can perfectly guess the state when they're orthogonal to each other, okay? And this is pairwise orthogonal, so this extends beyond two states. So let me just show you a super quick proof of this. Now, many of you have probably seen this before, but there's a really short proof that I really liked. A bit of a spoiler alert. So Vinny and I wrote a 2-page paper on this, okay? So I'll talk about what was in those 2 pages. But my original proof was like 1 page. So I was talking about measuring in eigenspaces and all this stuff, and I'm like, I want a one-line proof of this. So this is the one-line proof, okay? If they're orthogonal to each other, then it's not too hard to come up. If you just measure in a basis consisting of the eigenvectors, you can sort it out, okay? So that part's kind of easy. The hard part is if they're perfectly distinguishable, then they have to be orthogonal. So this is the one-line proof, okay? So, well, first I'll set up the setting again. Right here, this inner product is going to be the probability of given that you're given the state rho I, this is going to be the probability that you're going to output the index j, okay? So what you should be guessing is I, but you're guessing j. So you need these inner products to be zero, okay? Otherwise, there would be a positive probability of making a mistake, okay? So what you do is just multiply the states together, stick in this funny way of writing the identity in between them, and because of this condition, none of these MKs survive being multiplied by rho I and rho j, okay? So that whole thing is equal to zero and they have to be orthogonal, okay? So there we go, there's a little bit of proof. Does anyone recognize this, by the way? I showed this to my undergrad class and no one recognized it. I think this is Rob, do you remember this? Ellie, you got it. Okay, good. Someone's old like me, that's good. So why do we care about state discrimination, okay? First of all, it's a fun task, okay? This is a task I use very early on when I'm teaching quantum to new people, because you have states and you have measurements, and then you have to think about what the states are and what the measurements are. And if I give you some states, what kind of measurements can you create? If I give you the measurements, what kind of states, well, like what properties do the states have? So it's really just taking the two first building blocks and, you know, really having a lot of fun. You can call it machine learning if you want to get some funding for it. So the first time I saw it was quantum cryptography, okay? So I was looking at bit commitment and such things like that. And being able to learn how information is encoded into states was very important in cryptography. I mean, it still is. But that's the first context in which I saw it. But you know, once you have this task in your head, you kind of start seeing it everywhere. So you can also look at like algorithms, such as Hinn subgroup problems, or in particular, Shor's factoring algorithm. And you can just think of it as you have an algorithm that's going to spit out some states. How many states do you need before you can learn your answer? Okay. So you can write like Shor's factoring algorithm in this setting as well. Okay. And I mean, this kind of is all over the place. You've probably seen it somewhere before. Okay, so now I'm going to put a twist on the problem. Maybe I'll pause if there's any questions. All right. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about anti-distinguishability, okay? So those four letters are going to change the game up a lot. So here's the new game. Alice is going to prepare one of the states, psi 1 up to psi n. So I'm going to concentrate mostly on pure states, but our results are in terms of pure states, but this generalizes. Alice is going to prepare one and send it to Bob. So same as before. But now Bob has to guess what state it's not. Okay? So let's run through an example. Okay, this is a completely different task. So let me talk about what's going on. So here's an example. We have a bunch of states. Alice prepares, let's say, psi 1. Sends it over to Bob. And now Bob is going to make kind of a funny guess, say this is not psi 2. Okay? And that corresponds to a correct guess. Okay? So it's much more vague, but yeah, he can do this. So let me tell you the difference. So let me tell you what exactly I'm doing here. We want to know when you can do this perfectly. Okay? You can always make a guess, and you say this is not psi I, and you'll always be correct. Okay? In general, if you care about probabilities, this is a much easier game. Like if I have a million states and I send one to Bob, and Bob could just randomly pick one, he doesn't even have to measure it or anything. He just randomly picks an index, then there's a super high probability that it's going to be correct. We don't care about super high probabilities. We care about perfect, when you can do this perfectly. So.
I assume it's you led us into this, but wouldn't your previous proof only require anti-distinguishability in order to run through it?
You mean the orthogonality?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the question. So I'm going to very soon talk about what conditions on a set of states can guarantee you that it's anti-distinguishable, or can guarantee you that it cannot be. And it's much more interesting than just orthogonality. That's where things get really interesting. So let me nail down the definition. So we're going to be given a set of states, okay? And we're going to say this anti-distinguishable if Bob has a perfect strategy for guessing which state was not sent. Okay? And compared to perfect distinguishability, whenever you have a set of states and there's a perfect strategy for guessing what state was sent. Okay? So the differences are in the purple four letters and this purple three letters. Okay? Go ahead.
So Bob has access to the complete set of states except
yes.
One. It's not set by one and like.
Oh, that's right. This is a single shot task.
Single shot.
Yeah. And Bob knows what the states are.
No,
Alice is sampling one.
The previous one, Alice sends one state and Bob needs to find the index. Here, Alice sends a bunch of states and Bob has access to all of them and he needs to know which one is not there.
That's right. So the answer could be a single index as well, but it's the index is an index that it's not.
Sure. But she doesn't send all the states to Bob, right?
She sends one state.
She only sends one state to Bob. So just like...
Okay, so it is like the previous protocol.
Yeah.
She sends one
yes.
state and he can say this is not this other state.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Everything is exactly the same except what Bob wishes to do at the end.
Okay.
So. He either wants to guess what index it is, or in this case, what index it's not, but still a single index outcome. Yeah.
So now there are n minus one possible correct outcomes.
You could think of it that way.
Yeah.
Or instead of saying n minus one things, just say the one that is not in that list.
But
I mean, same as if you say it's two or three, that's the same as saying not one. So
yeah,
you could do it either way if
so
you want.
Let's say Bob has n possible states, and sends state number three. Sorry, Alice sends state number three, let's say.
That's right.
Then a correct answer for Bob would be to say, if Bob says one, that's correct, right?
Yeah.
Bob says two, it's also correct.
Yeah.
Bob says four is correct. And so
yeah,
so
he could do that as well.
One possible wrong.
Yeah, but Yeah, you could think of it that way as well. You could think of it that way as well.
The way you set it up, it sounds to me like Bob reports like not site two or not site one. So really what he's answering is subsets. So like it sounds to me like his answers ought to be, you know, the subset one and two, or the subset one and three, or the subset two and three. Like,
that's right.
These are the allowed possibilities.
Yeah.
That's the same as excluding one.
Uh-huh.
So like he's...
I think it's going to be the same thing at the end of the day, though. I mean, the way I described it was what you said, yes. But at the end of the day, Bob is going to make... I think it's safer, and it's probably the same, but it's safer just to say he's going to respond with an index that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which going back to what Rob said, you could think of it as the whole subset of those things that doesn't have that one index. Like instead of saying not two, you could say one, three, or four, which is a subset. Yeah.
So Jim, the question of that.
Yeah.
So if I think of it in this other way, then there's a whole spectrum of tasks between distinguishability and anti-distinguishability.
Yeah.
Where I could say something like, let's say I have a set of n states, you know, that distinguishability is you know, I give an answer which is a subset of one,
mm-hmm.
and I want to always sort of guess correctly. And on the other end, it's like, I guess a subset of n minus one, and I want my guess to always be correct.
That's right.
I could be guessing a subset of two, three, four, n minus two.
Yeah. Yep, that's future work.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. So we're sorting out this problem, and I'll show you where we're at. And then the next paper that we have in maybe 6 months is talking about that problem, where you want to say it's not, fix a subset of size M, and you say it's not any of these.
Or fix a subset of size N minus M and say it's definitely in this subset.
That's right. Exactly. Yep. Yep.
What do you call that?
We call it M state exclusion.
State.
I mean, maybe we should stick the word anti-distinguishability in there. Yeah, we're working on the title. We could say perfect state exclusion, although I'm firmly committed to calling it anti-discrimination right now, so or anti-distinguishability, so we'll see. So as far as we know, so we've looked into this a bit, and there's been a little bit of work on 2 out of 4 exclusion, but I think the general case is quite open. If you want to rule out, say, 3 of 6 or something. But yeah, that's a really interesting generalization of this. Any other questions about this? So kind of the, you know, what's going on in this task is perfect distinguishability, which is not something usually people even talk about because it just means they're orthogonal. That's the end of the story. You know, I presented everything that we need to know about that. But for anti-distinguishability, things are more interesting. So here's an example. So consider these three states, psi 0, psi 1, and psi 2 in the blue here. Okay. You may have seen these referred to as the trine states. Okay. So this is just on the span of ket 0 and ket 1. And these three states are not orthogonal. They're not even linearly independent. Okay. You have three states in two dimensions. But you can always exclude one of these, okay? For example, it's not quite a basis measurement, but I'll talk about that in a sec. So take this state that's orthogonal to psi 0, this state that's orthogonal to psi 2, and this state that's orthogonal to psi 1. And if you add up those things, the density operators, you'll get a multiple of the identity.
Sorry, okay? Why is psi 0 orthogonal to psi 0 if it's at 90 degrees?
Oh, this is not a block sphere.
Oh, not a block sphere.
You'll never see a block sphere in any of my slides. I don't understand block spheres. This is good old-fashioned Euclidean geometry. Yeah.
Sorry, but what is the geometry? What is the meaning of the geometry then?
Maybe I should have had an origin, some axes. But anyway, so this is ket 0.
Mm-hmm.
This is ket 1. X plane, Y plane. Think back to like grade 6. That's none of this block stuff.
The subspace of a two-dimensional Hilbert space.
Yeah.
I see.
I mean, this exact same thing works on the block sphere as well, but you just take antipodal points.
Yeah.
And that might be easier to see for some. This is the way I think about it.
Okay, I need to educate my brain for a bit. I understand it. Okay, continue.
Let's see, I think if you look on the block sphere and take a great circle and take three equally spaced out points.
Yeah.
So take those as your three qubits and then take the antipodal points of each of those.
Yeah.
And those things average to the middle, which is the identity.
Yeah.
I think that's how the block sphere works. But then the point is that these orthogonal things, they add up to a multiple identity. So you just scale it down. It's going to preserve all the zero inner products that we want. And you can always perfectly exclude one of these states. Okay. Which is interesting, because I've seen these trine states show up everywhere, but I didn't know why anyone cared about them. And I don't know if this is the reason, but now it's the reason why I care about them.
Jamie, who's the first person who pointed this out? Do you know?
I'm not sure. So,
it's like it could be a quite old observation.
Yeah. So before we started working on this, the case when you have three states was already kind of well and done and known. It's whenever you have four states. That's whenever things were unknown.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not sure.
And the people who did that, is it Stephen Barnett and that crowd and Mark Killerby and folks like that who did the first results in state exclusion?
Now, state exclusion is quite an old task. So I'm going to talk about the paper that I think you're referring to in a second, that kind of deals with it from the STP approach. But yeah, I'm not sure how old state exclusion dates back to. It might date back to like the 60s, whenever people really started studying discrimination properly. But, so let me tell you about the conjecture that got some of us interested. Okay, so the conjecture here is if you have the states psi 1 up to psi n, okay, so n states living in n dimensions, complex dimensions, this is anti-distinguishable when the inner products are small enough. Okay, so they don't have to be zero, because remember this is kind of an easier task. Like the probabilities get pretty close to one pretty quickly if you want to look at probabilities. But if they're smaller than some threshold, then it's anti-distinguishable. Okay. So this is a conjecture, and there's actually some kind of something hidden in this conjecture. At the end of the day, it's also saying that maybe distinguishability is a function of the inner products. Sorry, anti-distinguishability. Okay. Now, whenever I started thinking about this, this wasn't immediately clear to me. Because perfect distinguishability, all the states have to be orthogonal. But orthogonality can kind of hide a lot of functions, okay? So it's just inner product to zero. Could be the trace distance is equal to 2. Could be some fidelity is equal to 0. There's a lot of ways to generalize orthogonality. But anyway, we have this thing right here. I'll talk about the inner product thing in a second. But there's the conjecture. So is this true? All right, so here's my first co-author, Vinny, he's right here. This is when we started working on it. So here's a conversation we had in 2019. Okay, we actually had it in the bistro down here. So I said, this conjecture looks interesting. To which Vinny replied, it sure does. And that was the whole conversation. It's a very short, we're men of few words. So we thought about this for a while. I mean, for like most of a lunch, I guess. 2 years later, there's that kind of 2 years. Vinny emailed me and said, are you still alive? And we didn't talk for a while. And he's like, by the way, I left my computer running for 2 years and I found a counterexample to that conjecture. Okay, to which I responded, what conjecture? Wait, what are you talking about, Vinny? That was a long time ago. So here's a counterexample. So we found four states in four dimensions that all have small inner product, but are not anti-distinguishable. Okay. So these things were all firmly below these thresholds. Okay. And this was a fun little paper. It's only 2.5 pages. So we just published it as a letter. So let me tell you a little bit about what's going on here. OK? Okay, so the whole paper wasn't just here's four states. I mean, that was most of the paper, I guess. What you can do is actually study how anti-distinguishable it is, and you can kind of come up with a way to prove. If I just give you a set of four states, you can prove it's not anti-distinguishable. Okay? Proving it is anti-distinguishable is not too bad. You just give me the measurements. I just verify these things make zero inner products, and you're done. But to certify you can't find these measurements, well, this is where semi-definite programs come in. Okay? And I'm over halfway in, and I haven't talked about semi-definite programs yet, so it's a new record. So basically, what we want to do is look at this optimization problem. Okay? We want to optimize over all measurements. Okay? So this is the algebraic characterization of all POVMs. And up here, this is going to be the sum of the possible errors. Okay? Because if I give you the state rho I, and then you say this is not rho I, then that's bad. So right here, then you're just going to add up those errors, and you want to minimize those possible errors. Right? So this actually gives you some kind of probability of success towards this. And this is what those folks studied in that paper. They kind of looked at that STP and redid a bunch of nice STP things. So here's a lemma. Basically, we want to know when you have a bunch of states that are anti-distinguishable, it's if and only if the optimal value of that optimization problem is equal to zero. Okay? So again, we don't care about probabilities. We just want to know if this is a hard zero or if it's positive. And can we use this STP to prove anything?
Sorry, Jimmy, and are you confined to a Hilbert space of dimension exactly equal to the number of states in this problem?
Right here. Conjecture. That's right. Yeah. So these states are known, the fixed dimension and everything. These are POVMs of that dimension.
But dimension n. Not just fixed, but dimension n.
This STP doesn't care about, the number of states and the dimension can be separate parameters.
But in your conjecture, they were the same.
In their conjecture, it is. In our results, you don't need that.
So you're going to give us a result that's not just about showing that conjecture to be false, but more general than that.
Yes. Okay. Soon I'm going to talk about, we won't care about the dimensions at all, actually.
Okay.
So right here, so this is a dual STP. Okay, if you haven't seen it before, basically the idea is that if you have an STP, there's a recipe to write down another optimization problem. Okay, and I followed that recipe, and that's where that came from. And that thing can tell us something about the original problem. Okay, I'm not going to go too deep, but that's the idea. You can show that these two values are equal. So therefore, we care whenever that thing is equal to zero. Okay. And now what's neat about the dual is that this is a different, it's kind of like taking the algebra and kind of turning it on its head. Because if I say, hey, this thing is zero, if and only if it's anti-distinguishable, if you stare at it for a while and you understand the context, you could probably believe me. But if I say, hey, look, I want to maximize the trace of something, and that something has to be less than some states, that doesn't even have an operational characterization, as far as I know. Why should this be related to anti-distinguishability? That's where STPs come in. So basically, I'm going to look at that. I did a quick sleight of hand here. I changed these to pure states. That's all. So you have a bunch of pure states are anti-distinguishable if and only if there does not exist a y that satisfies these conditions, just like up here. And that y is positive trace. Okay. If it was positive trace, and since you're maximizing, it's only going to get larger and larger, so it's definitely not zero.
Question.
Yep.
That last condition reminds me of the BFM compatibility condition, which is Finkelstein-Merman.
Okay.
When are a set of quantum states what? Different observers might assign as their limited information about something.
Mm-hmm.
And there, sort of like, is it the case that there's sort of something common to their Hilbert space support.
That's right, that's right.
Maybe it's different.
Yeah, I've thought about it. It also has to do, there's some entropies that also kind of look like that as well. You know, you want something that's kind of in the support of a bunch of other states. I'm not sure. I mean, if you have an idea how to think about that, I'd love to hear it, because I've been thinking about it for a long time. I mean, not full time, but now and then I come back to it. And, but yeah, the only interpretation I have is like you have some chunk of a, you know, you have a state, or you have an object right here, maybe a subnormalized state or something. And all of its support, even the magnitudes of the support, have to be contained in the supports of these states. Okay, anyway, yeah, we could talk about that later, maybe. But yeah, the point is that this will give us a certificate. And what is a certificate? If I give you a Y that satisfies these conditions with positive trace, then that set absolutely cannot be anti-distinguishable. Okay? So now we have a certificate that these measurements can exist. Does that kind of make sense? Any questions? But I went a little quick over the STP stuff, but. So how can we find these interesting set of states? So here's a totally legit algorithm. Well, pandemic, this is pretty much what you did, Vinny. Well, pandemic, generate four random states, calculate the maximum inner product, okay, whenever I does not equal J. Calculate that STP value. And what we want is those inner products to be as small as possible, all of them. But we want the STP value to still be zero, okay? Or you want it to be as small as possible, such that the STP value is still positive. You know, you want to find this kind of boundary point. And if the numbers are good, stop and write a paper. Okay. So this is pretty much the whole paper. You can also print the dual solution as a certificate. Okay. So we have a certification that is not anti-distinguishable. Calculate inner products, and you're done.
Sorry, question.
Yeah.
Did it actually take 2 years to run this on your computer?
I think Vinny did it during the winters to heat it. that's a joke. I don't know how much time it actually took.
But if you wanted to redo the calculation yourself.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that.
How long would it take?
It probably finds it pretty quick given your code now.
I think so, yeah. The code's open source. You can check it out. Yeah. It's linked in the paper. We can talk about it offline too if you're interested. But yeah, you could probably run it. Not anywhere close to 2 years, you'd probably find it. So if you do have heating problems in your house, you can talk to me as well.
Yeah, so thanks. I wanted to advertise Vinny's code. So yeah, it actually has a proper code, probably on a GitHub or something like that. It's a little bit nicer than that. So, so anyway, that's the whole paper. You don't know this guy? It's Nicolas Cage, the best actor in the world.
He's not very big in Iceland.
Oh, okay. That's a shame. One day he will. Okay. All right. Okay. So yeah. So that's the whole paper. Now let me introduce you, the new another co-author, Nathaniel Johnston. Okay. So, about 15 minutes after he saw our paper, he sent us an email. And he's like, oh, I made this number way better. Or not way better, made it a little bit better. And he's like, oh, I also found an example of friend equals 5. Okay, Nathaniel can probably just, it's like the matrix to him. He just saw the numbers and he just made the vectors and it was great. So we're like, hey, maybe we should properly study this thing. So, we formed the math. This is a picture taken at our last group meeting. They didn't know. And that's Thanos. So what we did is we came up with a corrected version of this, okay? So whenever you have this property, okay? So it's a little bit different, but let me get back to the original conjecture. If you have this function of all the inner products, and it's less than n squared over 2, which is another way of saying they're all kind of smallish, then it has to be anti-distinguishable, okay? So let me, I'll come back to the math here, but I don't want to slow down yet. Here's the corollary of this. To make it look like this conjecture, It's whenever all the inner products are less than this quantity. Okay. So when all those inner products are less than that quantity, you'll get that, you'll get this bound in the middle. Okay. So this is to, you know, something that we can actually prove.
Is that necessary and sufficient?
I'm glad you asked, Ellie. The top one is tight for all n. Okay. So if you have this quantity, then it's tight. But if you raise it even by an epsilon, then you can find examples that are not anti-distinguishable. Okay. So this is tight. Okay. And the bottom one, we proved it's tight for n equals 4. Okay. So going back to that conjecture where we found states the inner product is less than 2/3, the real answer for n equals 4 is 1 over square root 3, which is around 0.57.
Jim?
Yes?
Well, accurate. Whereas the original conjecture was for n vectors in a Hilbert space of dimension n, your theorem does not have that constraint.
That's right.
Any dimension.
That's right. Hilbert space. That's right. That's right. Yeah. I purposely left off this dimension bound here. Yeah. But if you have four dimensions, if you have four states, you can always put them in four dimensions if you want. So, and we just look at the span of those four states. But it's also true, like, if they don't have to live in four dimensions. And I think the optimal examples actually live in two dimensions. I'd have to double check that.
Well, you can always find...
I think it might be true that the optimal examples here live in two dimensions, but I can't. Is that true? I need to remember. Yeah, maybe.
It must become impossible at some point. Like if I have 2D and I just keep increasing the number, then I won't be able to satisfy this bound. There'll be so many high overlaps.
Yes. So that's exactly what I want to talk about right now. So we try to extend this version to dimension more than five, or having more than five states. And we found this was super tricky. And what we believe is that this is maybe not equivalent, but at least related to some open problems in math. Okay? And those open problems are exactly what you started to say. Now, if I, here's an open problem in math. I think it's open. If you have a bunch of unit vectors, let's say we have n vectors, and you have d dimensions, and you want to ask if they can all exist such that they all have a fixed inner product, or maybe bounds on the inner product. And then, so if I give you those parameters, the number of vectors, the number of dimensions, and the inner products, let's say they all make the same inner product, can you find such vectors, yes or no? Okay. And there's a lot of interesting open problems there, and I think n equals 5 is whenever things start getting into the unknown territory.
Sorry, isn't it the linear program?
It's a what?
Isn't it the linear program to find, or?
That would be quadratic.
Quadratic.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because of linear products, yes.
Yes, and you can turn it into a semi-definite program in ways that I can't explain yet. but in the semi-definite program, you can't bound the dimension. So.
Does that have anything to do that from that step to that step, you need to find solutions to that polynomial equation in radicals? And that's not possible for n larger or equal
to. You mean going from here to here?
Yeah.
So from going to here, there's some loss of parameters because it's something like they all have to be the same. I think this would be tight if you can find an optimal example where these are all the same. Okay. It's kind of like, you know, you're switching norms, you know, and then it's kind of like a two norm. This is some weird maximum norm. And then it's like, okay, but there's some, you know, differences between these two things. You know, when you convert between norms, there's some losses. So we tried to prove it for n equals 5, but we ran into some mathematical obstacles that we think are pretty big. And I'll come back and show you what these optimal examples are in a second. Okay, so here's another theorem. And this is, so we proved this, and then later we realized It was also in this paper by Bandyopadhyay, Jain, Oppenheim, and Perry on exclusion. I think this is the paper you're talking about, Rob. I think it was in Appendix E, which we missed, unfortunately. I mean, we caught it. So, but anyway, what this is saying is that if you have a set of states, then they cannot be anti-distinguishable. Okay, so it's the opposite. It cannot be if the inner products are, again, large. Okay, the other one said they have to be when they're small enough. This one says it cannot be when it's big enough. Okay, and this is the bound. And actually, the proof of this is quite easy. You just look at the semi-definite program. Okay, I mean, one way to prove it, you look at the semi-definite program and you just give that Y matrix that I talked about earlier. Okay, and actually that Y matrix is actually quite simple. It's basically the all ones matrix. Okay, so it's actually very easy to do this.
Sorry, can you compare this to the condition for must be distinguishable?
Yeah.
N squared over 2. And you said that that one is tight.
Yeah. I know what you're thinking. I went down this road too. So what we have is whenever they're all small, then they have to be.
Right.
Okay. When they're all small, they have to be. They're all large, they cannot be.
Okay.
And those two things have a gap between them.
Right.
They don't overlap. For N equals 3, they're actually equal.
But the idea is that if it's in the middle,
you
can find a pair which is and you can find a pair which isn't. Because you said like it's tight for N.
You can find an example for which it goes one way and a different example that goes the other way.
Exactly.
That's right. That's right.
Examples have exactly the same overlaps but different sets of vectors. Is that correct?
No. You can
different sums of overlaps.
Yeah. In absolute value. So I'll talk about like what thinking about different states and some equivalences in a second.
Is that also tight though?
You're asking some great questions, but you're always 30 seconds ahead of me. I'll talk about that in a sec. So that's Nicolas Cage again. So the corollary.
No idea.
I know at least one person learned something today. It warms my heart. A bunch of states cannot be indistinguishable whenever it's strictly above that bound. Okay? And oddly enough, and I don't know why, but this bound is equal to that bound. Different statement, but the thresholds are the same. And I don't know why. One of life's mysteries.
Wait, is it the opposite conjecture, basically?
Well, one is saying if they're all below this, then they have to be anti-distinguishable. And we proved if they're all above that, then they cannot be.
So it's like the, what's it called?
It's not the contrapositive or anything like that.
It's not the contrapositive.
No, it's something different.
It's the other one.
It's the other one. I think that was the technical term we use in our meetings as well. That is tight for all n, okay, which I'll talk about in a second. And that, the way you translate between the corollary and the original thing, it's actually tight for that as well, the exact same example. Okay. So this was not in the original, the Bandyopadhyay and Friends' paper. We proved it was tight. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, so n equals 3, this was known before. In the context of anti-distinguishability, this was also known. Or one of the bounds. This, like whenever they all get below 1/2, then they have to be anti-distinguishable. But anyway, this is an optimal example. Okay? So for n equals 3, this is an optimal example for both of the results we have. Okay? So if the inner products get less than 1/2, they have to be anti-distinguishable. If they're all strictly bigger than 1/2, they cannot be. Okay?
Can we stay on that for a second? So it's
sure.
Three states which are non-adjoint, like two of them are close together and one's far apart.
Yes, so that is something we don't prove. Okay, so if you have some that are small and some that are big, it's not going to fit into either of these baskets. So it's not, neither one of our theorems apply, so you can't use them to say anything. You'd have to go straight back to the SDP and solve that. Yeah.
Oh.
So we're only looking at vectors that are all, what is this, close together, large inner product, or when they're all far apart. Yeah.
And you can only do that if the Hilbert space dimension is.
Yeah. So in all of our results, we don't care about Hilbert space dimension. I'll tell you soon why we don't care. So, but in this case, if you want to make all the inner products larger, closer to each other, closer to being the same vector, then you could just add a third dimension and just start folding them up if you want. But you can't move these around anymore. These three things minimize the maximum, maximize the minimum. So
if I want to find four vectors on which I had the same inner product, that would need to be in a 3D.
Yeah. So for n is bigger than 3, we need a new definition. So what we're actually going to look at is the Gram matrix. And the Gram matrix is going to be the matrix that looks at all the possible inner products. Okay? So the ij entry is going to be the inner product between the ith one, the psi I and psi j. Okay? And Gram matrices have been looked at a lot before. And basically, they're positive and semi-definite and Hermitian. Okay, and this is actually if and only if it's a Gram matrix. And here's a lemma: we only need to look at the Gram matrix. Okay, so if I give you a set of states, and I ask if it's anti-distinguishable or not, then it's only a matter of what the Gram matrix looks like. Okay. So I think this is answering something similar to what you're talking about. And here is I call it a fake proof. I don't know if it's a full proof, but I think it's convincing. Okay, it's not the proof we have in the paper, but it's convincing. If you have maybe I should speed up a little bit. If you have a bunch of states that are anti-distinguishable, then you can find a measurement, blah, blah, blah. But if you rotate all those states, there's some unitary, then you can account for that unitary in the measurements. Okay, so you just update the measurements, and it's still going to be an anti-distinguishing measurement. So at the end of the day, if you have the set of states, and the set of states is unitarily invariant, so really all you need to look at is the inner products. Okay, I don't know if that's a full theorem, but that's an argument. Does that make sense? Like now we've proven that the notion of anti-distinguishability is just a matter of all the inner products, okay? Which wasn't clear at the beginning, okay? There we go. So here's an optimal example. There's gonna be a quiz at the end. I'm gonna give you a bunch of pictures. So now I don't even need to talk about vectors anymore. Which is good, because they get ugly. I can just give you this beautiful Gram matrix like this. So you have ones on the diagonal. You have a non-negative parameter gamma. It ranges from 0 to 1. Okay, and you can just prove at some point, whenever your gamma is small, these are nearly orthogonal. And when it equals 1, they're nearly identical. So now we have this gamma parameter that's just going to kind of do this. I went too far. 90 degrees like this. And at some point, it's going to be, no, you cannot anti-distinguish anymore. And then it'll stay in no. And that's the threshold right there. Okay. So you could do this numerically. And Vinny has some nice graphs. But we prove this rigorously as well. And that same example, when you translate between the theorem and corollary, since these are all equal to each other, it's also going to be tight for that as well. Okay. So whatever vectors generate this Gram matrix is going to be tight for that bound. But this doesn't quite work for the lower bound. So we need a new example. Okay, so we're thinking, how do we come up with these lower bound optimal examples? Okay. And then Vinny came up with the idea, what if the Gram matrix is circulant? Okay? And we had absolutely no idea where he came up with this. He really just pulled it out of thin air. But then we're like, hey, this actually solves all of our problems. So, and then 30 seconds later, Nathaniel proved it worked. And yeah, Vinny was the hero of the day. So, what is circulant? Circulant matrices are really nice. They show up in places. This is what it looks like. So you have a matrix, you write down its first row. The second row is going to be the same one copied, but shifted over by one. Except this thing is going to wrap around like that. And then you take that row, shift it, and you get the third row. So you get these nice kind of super diagonals being constant. Okay. And this ends up being optimal for the lower bound. And yeah, since it has to be Hermitian, positive, semi-definite, and circulant, there's not too many degrees of freedom at the end of the day. Maybe I'll skip this. So this is an STP proof of why the Gram matrix is sufficient. You just kind of do a change of variables. I will kind of just skip over that. I'm just going to scan over this really quick. So this characterization of anti-distinguishability is very interesting to Nathaniel and to us, but really interesting to Nathaniel. And what we prove is that a set of states is anti-distinguishable if and only if its Gram matrix is n minus 1 incoherent. N minus 1 incoherent, I can quickly say what this is. This is whenever you can decompose this Gram matrix in a very particular way. So incoherent, one way to say that, like regular incoherent, means it has to be diagonal, you know, in some fixed spaces, but it has to be diagonal. So right here, we generalize the idea of diagonality. You have a matrix N here, okay? And what you do is you zero out the whole ith row and column, okay? And if you can decompose your Gram matrix, or any matrix for that matter, in terms of a matrix with the first row and column zeroed out, plus another matrix with the second row and column zeroed out, and you keep doing that, then this is called N minus 1 incoherent. And this is super interesting to Nathaniel because he just finished writing a whole paper on N minus 1 incoherence. And this just worked. It just worked. I'll just fast forward a little bit. But basically, Nathaniel was able to lift some of the neat theorems from incoherence, N minus 1 incoherence, to prove exactly what we want. So the eigenvalues of G, if they satisfy some certain eigenvalue inequality, then it's anti-distinguishable. Okay, I'm not going to go through the proof. It deals with n minus 1 incoherence.
Is that for circular ones, or that's in general?
That's in general. 30 seconds ahead again. Fantastic, Elia. I love it. I'm going to come back to that. Yeah. So right here, our bound is exactly the Frobenius norm on the Gram matrix. You have the sum of the things squared. And now, the moment Ellie was waiting for. If it's circulant, then this is if and only if. So you can prove that if you violate that a little bit for circulance, then it cannot be anti-distinguishable.
Cool.
Right, so let me just quickly say some open problems, and then...
can you go back to my slide for a second?
Yeah. One second, there's a bit of a delay here. Yeah, right here.
Okay, cool.
One thing that's really neat about circular matrices is that they're always diagonalized in the Fourier basis. I think that's really neat. And that's kind of the structure that we use to pull out this in a, if and only if.
The
discrete quantum Fourier transform. If you look at the columns, those are the eigenvectors And that's if and only if. Circulant if and only if diagonalizable in the Fourier basis. Yeah, people have studied circulant matrices, and you know, a lot of things are well understood about them. So they take advantage of those. Let me talk about some open problems, some open questions. Is there an interpretation of these results? Okay. So, you know, there's a couple of ways to start talking and learning about quantum theory. You say, you know, these are quantum states. They're represented as vectors. Here's the measurements. Here's Born's rule. And then you can start talking about distinguishability or not distinguishability, which is more or less the approach I took in this talk. Or you could say, hey, look, here's quantum theory. It's different than classical theory because, you know, you have uncertainty principles and stuff like that. And you can't learn, you can't just learn whatever you want, you know? So, yeah, so the idea is like, you know, you get these orthogonality, it relates to perfect distinguishability, but, you know, if you just change the test to perfect, like this anti-distinguishability, is there a way to kind of think about them when you're really thinking about, you know, mathematical representations of quantum vectors and stuff? Another problem, there we go. Are there any GPTs where anti-distinguishability is interesting? Okay, so there's some really neat GPTs out there that have kind of a distinguishability flavor to them. You know, if you define the measurements to look like this or not, then maybe you can start distinguishing more states than you ought to be allowed to, okay? And at the end of the day, why I think the interpretation of GPTs might be interesting is, you know, this is an operationally motivated task. Alice prepares a state, Bob measures a state, and, you know, he makes a guess and it's right or wrong, okay? You don't really even have to talk about vectors to discuss this, okay? It's very operationally defined. Does this have a connection to the PBR theorem at all? So the previous paper, the Oppenheim and Friends paper, they talked about the connection to the PBR theorem. Okay. And you know, there's a lot of common connections. So, but I'm not sure. But we haven't went down that road yet. Oh, it shows up over here. Okay. Is there a nice application of these examples? So quantum state discrimination shows up in a lot of places, in crypto, in algorithms. But what about anti-distinguishability? I'm not sure. And yeah, is there anything circulant matrices can't do? That's the end of my talk. Thanks everyone for listening.
So why is Nicholas Cage the proxy for?
Well, he was my inspiration for waking up in the morning and to get put on my pants and do some math. Yeah. No, I don't know. I just think he's funny.
Good. Good to know.
How do you prove the tightness of the bound?
Right. So basically what you do is you just find an example such that as the example gets closer and closer to that bound, I mean, this is kind of the general approach. It's like, okay, if the, let me actually show some of these things.
Okay, so for A plus epsilon, you can find that it doesn't hold.
That's right, that's right.
You prove that for less it holds, but how do you prove that for less it holds? With SDPs or, I don't know.
Yeah, so I can't find it. These are really tiny.
I'm referring to
the one
of inner product is less than n squared.
Yeah, yeah. So that one, it's a little bit harder because basically you look at the inequality and then, yeah, right now I don't have a really quick and clear answer. It's basically a bunch of math right now. It's in the math, it's in the paper. And yeah, the paper's pretty much done. We just got one last coat of paint. But yeah, but the thing is that circulant matrices just kind of make the inequalities work in our favor. Yeah.
So it is a constructed. You guys show by manipulation, just plain.
I can't remember if it's constructive or not. It does leverage some incoherence results, which I don't have in my head right now. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So I'm not an expert in prepare and measure, but there probably with quantum states you can guess some message from Alice better than only classical resources.
Yes.
A comparison of the classical thing here.
Yeah, so prepare and measure is really interesting, and it's like the setting, but usually, or at least the way I think about prepare and measure, is you look at all the probabilities. Okay, Alice prepares this state, sends it to Alice, Alice measures, and then gets a probability, depending on how she measured and the state that was sent. Okay, so now you have an entire probability distribution or correlation. And then what this one cares about is whenever Bob's guess matches Alice's choice. So if you want, you could take it. I mean, for anti-distinguishability, yes, you can look at perfect or not. Yeah. So I guess the analogy is like if you can have a non-local game correlation and you can have a perfect strategy for the non-local game. Here you can have a prepare and measure correlation, and you only care about the ones that have a perfect strategy. Yeah. Hmm.
Have you thought about the unambiguous state exclusion problem or unambiguous, so that, you know, take a set of states that you can't anti-discriminate and then say, all right, if I'm allowed to assign some I don't know outcome to my POVM,
yeah,
can I then have some non-zero probability of anti-discriminating? Because I would imagine that you could also say, well, what's the criterion for a set of states not even being anti-distinguishable with any probability?
Right.
Maybe that criterion is simple. Maybe there's some simple criterion in the states for which that's the case.
Right. So what you can do is add an extra measurement that says, I don't know. An extra outcome, yeah. And then what you can do is look at the exact same STPs, exact same task, and everything.
Right.
And what you want to do at the end of the day is, you have the constraints that you never make a mistake. Mm-hmm. So that's the unambiguous part. And at the end of the day, you want to minimize the probability of, the probability of saying, I don't know.
So you'd have like a sum over your MIs, but it would go up to the sort of second last outcome of POVM. You'd still have your constraint that all the elements of POVM have summed to identity, but now the thing that you're optimizing is just the inner product of.
So there's kind of two ways to do this relaxation. One, you can still put the constraints that you never make a mistake. So these inner products are equal to zero.
Right.
And then you can minimize the probability of that last outcome in the POVM.
Sure.
Well, so that's one way to do it.
Maybe I don't care about the probability of reporting the I don't care outcome, but rather just what's the characteristic of a set of states such that even if you allow an I don't know outcome, you still can't anti-discriminate.
I'm not sure if the task is any different. If you still talk about perfectly, like the perfect case, and having the I don't know measurement, I don't think it's any different. The way I view it is that you can say, hey, look, you're never allowed to make a mistake. You are allowed to say, I don't know, this extra outcome, but you want to minimize the probability of that happening. And then anti-discrimination would be when that probability is equal to zero. So you never say, I don't know. You always make a guess, and you're always right. So it's a relaxation, but they're equivalent whenever that probability is equal to zero.
Sure.
That's the way I view it.
So am I misremembering what happens in just regular state discrimination? So I seem to think that if you define the task of unambiguous state discrimination, where you're saying, look, you're allowed one extra outcome in your POVM, where you say, I don't know, and now, people worry about what's the maximum probability that I kind of conclusively guess. But people also, I thought, worried about what kinds of quantum states is it possible such that I can have such an error-free discrimination, you know, ambiguous. Sometimes it says, I don't know.
Yeah.
But when it comes back to the answer, yes, I do know, it's error-free. And I thought if there were some sets of states where you just couldn't have any error-free discrimination. But maybe I'm misremembering. Your recollection as well.
if you can, if you're going to constrain it to never making mistakes, so it's unambiguous,
yeah.
And if you can do that perfectly, then they have to be orthogonal, I believe.
No, if I'm allowed to say, sometimes say I don't know.
Oh, sometimes, yes, yes, yes. That's right.
So that's where I'm at.
Okay.
And of course, you know, for non-orthogonal states, I can project them into orthogonal states. Basically, when I post-select on getting not the I don't know outcome, now they become orthogonal and I can discriminate them perfectly.
Yeah.
So is there something similar here that you can have a set of states that's not anti-distinguishable, but when I project them after having gotten, you know, some outcome besides I don't know, now they are a set of states which are anti-distinguishable.
Yeah.
So I can't. But, you know, for other states, that might not happen. There's no projection that will make them anti-distinguishable.
Okay.
Just like I think there are sets of states where, you know, just giving me the I don't know outcome, I still can't do an error-free discrimination after post-selecting on, you know, the results.
I see. I'm not entirely sure. I haven't thought about like doing this kind of phase one measurement and then post-selecting on it. I don't think I've seen that context in state discrimination, so it sounds interesting though. But in that case, the post-selection, I mean, you're losing some probabilities, right?
Yeah.
So there will be some kind of, I don't know, outcome, but in the first phase, you know, before the post-selection.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, that sounds interesting. I'm not sure. Yeah, think about that.
I think there's a classical analog to this where you look
yes.
at probability distributions and
yes.
asking what kinds of sets of probability distributions.
Right, and we just actually thought of this example recently. So if you have this distribution, so that's 1/2 probability gain,
yeah.
1, 2, or 3. Okay, so if you have that distribution, this distribution, and this distribution. Is that?
Let's see.
Yeah. So, you know, if someone gives you, if someone samples, you don't know which one, but they're sampling from one of them. And let's say Alice sends one, which was sampled from one of them, and you don't know which one. You know for sure it was not the third one. And if it's two, you know it wasn't that one. Three is not that one.
Right.
And I think this is some kind of classical analog of the trine states, and
base coding. So
yeah.
at a fourth state to your vector.
Yeah.
And then say, hey, there's a different coding where you don't have the possibility of anti-distinguishability because there's a place where they all overlap.
Yes.
And you can't exclude any of them.
That's right.
And what's nice about this example, so this is due to Peter Shore, as a kind of reaction to this paper by Joza and Schlins way back, where they were just sort of looking at the distinguishability of a set of states and whether there were features of the distinguishability, say, of three states that you couldn't infer from their pairwise distinguishabilities. And so
yeah.
They came up with an example of that. And then Peter Shore pointed out, well, there's a classical example of that as well, because these examples I just showed you, pairwise, these things have the same degree of distinguishability. They overlap in one spot.
That's right.
Only
that's right.
Have three-way distinguishability properties that
yeah.
are different.
Yeah.
And one way that it manifests is in their anti-distinguishability properties.
Ah, interesting.
So the Gram matrix, you know, because it's the inner products, not the inner products, absolute value, it contains more information than
yes.
just the pairwise distinguishabilities.
Yes.
And that's what you need classically as well. You can't just tell me the pairwise distinguishabilities and expect to be able to answer questions about whether these set of states is anti-distinguishable or not.
Yeah.
So I think there is an interesting
That's super interesting.
If you give me a bunch of distributions over some finite sample space,
mm.
what can I say about when they're anti-distinguishable?
Yeah. I don't think we thought about the classical one for a little bit, but
when you talk about the problem with distributions as opposed to states,
mm-hmm.
then you're thinking of a setup more close to a random access code of sorts. Where you have defined already.
Not quite.
The analog I would say is that in the task is just you're trying to discriminate among you know, which you're really trying to
guess some classical information. And we've been talking about encoding that classical variable in, you know, a set of quantum states, but you could also consider encoding it in a set of distributions. But the task is the same, that like I've encoded this classical variable in a set of distributions, you want to figure out which value it takes, then you have to discriminate these distributions, and if they overlap, you might not be able to do it perfectly. So it's still really just about the encoding of classical information, but it's a kind of classical noisy encoding rather than quantum encoding.
Yeah. At the end of the day, Alice has some index. She's encoding it in some way. And then Bob wants to kind of decode that and get back to the original index. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you told me the classical one is interesting, because now I'm going to spend more time thinking about it. I think we came up with this example really quick, and we're like, yeah, this is probably related to the trine states. Just get rid of the square roots or something like that.
What I'm interesting is this second example.
Yeah.
Of the different encoding.
Right.
Which isn't anti-distinguishable. Now you've got
That's right.
Examples that you're trying to characterize.
I wonder if there's... So for quantum, it's just like you have the whole collection of all the inner products, not modulus, but just them. And then classically, I wonder if you can see something very similar. Like it's still the collection, but.
We did spend some time trying to think about what's the minimum amount of information you need to give me about a set of distributions such that they form a kind of, just like quantumly, one set of states unitarily equivalent to another set of states if they have the same Gram matrix.
Yeah.
You know, classically you'd want to say something like, oh, well, the role of a unitary will now be played by the permutations on the sample space. So one of the distinguishabilities of some set of states the same as another under permutations. What's the minimum amount of stuff you need to tell me?
Right. So I think permutations will work. Stochastic definitely won't, because what you need, at the end of the day, you'll need to preserve the supports. Really all you care here is the patterns of zeros and ones. Or zero versus positive. So for every single index, there needs to be at least one that's a zero.
In order to have anti-distinguishability.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So stochastic matrices definitely won't work. Permutations will.
You're saying what will work for to preserve
okay,
the
so
all I was saying is that I'm not sure what the classical analog of the Gram matrix is. So forget about anti-distinguishability. It's not obvious, like it, quantumly we sort of know that unitary equivalence corresponds to equality of Gram matrices. Classically, there's sort of an analogous question, you know, permutational equivalence, two sets of distributions.
Yeah.
What does that mean in terms of, like, what can I tell you about that set of distributions? Things like the fidelities between pairs, well, that's not enough, I need to tell you more.
Mm-hmm.
What's that small bit more that's analogous to the phases in the Gram matrix? I'm not quite sure. If I tell you something about like triple wise fidelities or something like that, is that enough suddenly to tell me which permutational equivalence class I'm in?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I mean, I'm definitely not proposing permutations as necessarily the only thing that's going to preserve anti-distinguishability, but more just, yeah, what's the analog of the Gram matrix? That's not obvious. But maybe you don't need to answer that question to get started.
Let me pace for another 15 minutes. You know, there are some kind of quantum results where the classical analog is not quite as structured. It really, sometimes with quantum, you look at orthogonality and stuff like that. And classically, sometimes all you care about is patterns of zeros and non-zeros. And that is the exact analog. So, I mean, right now, if I had to put money on it, I would say that, you know, if you just apply permutation, that might be the most general thing you can do. Apply the same permutation on every probability vector. That's about maybe all the degree of freedom you have.
Sorry, I'm not sure what you're describing. If you apply permutation, then what?
If you have P1, P2, and P3, then, I mean, just let's just say you have P1, P2, and P3 that are classically anti-distinguishable. Then you can apply a permutation to each one, and I can make the same statement.
Right.
But I think that might be the most general operation you can do without having any structure on P1 and P2 and P3. I think if you do anything that's not a permutation that preserves vector, that preserves the probability distributions, then I don't think, I think you can mess it up.
Say item 3 is split into 3A and 3B. It's still going to be 0 for P1, non-zero for P2 and P3. So it should still be fine.
You're splitting this one into two?
Yeah. I'm splitting row 3 into two states, right? So I encode one state, and now imagine, oh, actually, so those halves become a quarter-quarter. That 0 becomes 0, 0. So now it's a four-element vector, still anti-distinguishable, but that's not a permutation.
Ah, okay. Yes, you're right. You're right. Yes. It has to be, yeah, okay. So if you mess around with the dimensions, then you have, it has to have the property where zero stays zero and, no, just zero stays zero, that's it. Positive numbers can go to zero.
So yeah. Basically unitary sandwiches, so I need to just preserve the products.
Well, now we should start thinking about isometries.
So
it's isometries now. So I should have said isometries in the talk in retrospect. So this is kind of like an isometry as well in some sense. You're preserving, like if you split this to 1/4, 1/4, this to 0, 0, and this to be whatever. Maybe to spice it up a bit, so that's too much. I'm adding probabilities. But if you have something like that.
Yeah. And then that's even crazier because the way you manipulate P1 is different from P2. And
yeah. Maybe it's a majorization argument or something. There exists a permutation such that the new probability vector is majorized by the first one or something like that.
These encodings of the constant information are best addressed using matrix majorization. We can talk about that.
But
I think this anti-distinguishability result, if there's one, it might be most naturally expressed in terms of matrix majorization relations.
That is a really cool example. I like that one. Yeah. Okay, yeah, that deserves my thought. That's really interesting. Any other questions? I think I'm quite over time.